saying. Say it!
I don't have to say nothing.
Danny! Let Neptune strike ye dead, Winslow! Hark! Hark! Triton! Hark! Bellow! Bid our father, the Sea King, rise from the depths full foul in his fury. Black waves teeming with salt foam to smother this young mouth with pungent slime. To choke ye, engorging your organs till ye turn blue and bloated with bilge and brine and can scream no more. Only when he, crowned in cockle shells, with slithering tentacled tail and steaming beard, take up his fell befinned arm. His coral tine trident screeches banshee-like in the tempest and plunges right through your gullet, bursting ye, a bulging bladder no more, but a blasted bloody film now, a nothing for the harpies and the souls of dead sailors to pick and claw and feed upon, only to be lapped up and swallowed by the infinite waters of the dread emperor himself. Forgotten to any man, to any time, forgotten to any god or devil, forgotten even to the sea, for any stuff or part of Winslow, even any scantling of your soul, is Winslow no more, but is now itself the sea.
All right, have it your way. I like to cook it.
Welcome to Movie Left, a movie review podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Montarulo, joined by my co-host, Comrade Dracula. Comrade, what's going on?
I wasn't ready for that question. I had a great story I told on the other cast we just recorded, our regular weekly political cast, and I got nothing. So it's good to be here. I've wanted to review this film for a while, and I feel like it's definitely a horror film. And definitely a very political film, definitely an anti-capitalist film in regard to labor and alienation from one's own labor. Yeah. And the relationship between the boss, or at least the middle manager, and the worker. And there was, you know, I liked the film from the get-go, but I didn't really pick up on some of those themes until I watched this. It was like a 45-minute long YouTube video called The Lies of the Lighthouse, that goes really in fucking depth, like great depth, about all these themes of anti-capitalism that the film explores. And this guy that did it's like not like, doesn't come off like a professional YouTuber. And at the end of it, he talks about his own day job cleaning houses. And you're like, holy shit, this guy's just like a regular fucking worker that like gets it, that totally fucking gets this movie. And then, you know, I went back and watched it again, and it's like, oh shit, there's no other theme to this movie besides this.
Well, and he sees his own experience in Pattinson's character. And this, the guy's name, by the way, his YouTube channel is The Acolytes of Horror. And I highly, also recommend that video for anyone that saw this film, because it really recontextualizes the movie in a way that like totally opened me up to like the actual, like, there's a lot of themes that are, you know, kind of surface level, and, you know, the directors talked about, you know, the kind of Greek mythology attached to some to these characters, and, you know, how their story was a retelling of those characters in some ways. But the real story of the movie is clearly this basically just an allegory for capitalism. And the director and writer, Robert Eggers himself, said that he had previous drafts of the script that were too clear. And he rewrote it multiple times to make the audience feel as disoriented and unstable and as unsure of reality as Winslow is during the filming. I don't know if we should just decide on a name to call him now, because he's got a million fucking names. But Robert Pattinson's character starts off telling Willem Dafoe's character that his name is Ephraim Winslow. Now, we later find out in the film that his name is actually Thomas Howard, and that he took the name and identity of this logger, Ephraim Winslow, who was killed in a logging accident that he basically let happen, so he can kind of, you know, use that that name to pad it, basically to pad his resume. It was the equivalent of lying on your resume to improve your station in life, which we know everyone fucking does, because sure. You know, it's just an arbitrary stupid thing.
I mean, you could go to a probate court and change your fucking name anytime you want to. Like, it's
yeah,
it sort of lends itself to the idea that, like, he doesn't like his fucking boss. His boss was an asshole, and he may have actually killed his boss for the level of guilt he has, but, you know, killed him specifically because he wanted that name and that identity and whatever reputation that person had to you know, basically identity theft. It wasn't just like, oh, I want a better name. It was, I want to be this guy because this guy has power and control, and I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, we're going to get into the themes, you know, throughout the film, but I want to talk about the movie itself, devoid of themes, for a minute, because just purely as an accomplishment, I think this is just an incredible piece of filmmaking. Robert Eggers, who has only directed one other film, The Witch, which came out in 2015, another A24.
Or The Vitch.
The Vitch, yeah. Stylized W. Yeah, it's, which I have not seen. I'll, you know, cards on the table, but I do actually mean to, and especially after seeing this, I'm going to seek out, because I think he's, you know, clearly an incredible filmmaker from the get-go. Like, and he's clearly got an appreciation both for modern and classic horror, but also for thinking man's horror. Like, you know, I always say, like, horror movies are the best horror movies either shine a light on an injustice in society, or on, you know, on a conflict within, you know, all of humanity. Like, it's just, horror is supposed to say something.
Lighthouse pun there for you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. No, not even intentional. But it, horror is really, the best horror is supposed to say something. And obviously, you know, great horror movies like Halloween have been, you know, parodied and copied and bastardized for, you know, years, and they've spun off into all of these kind of, like, just movies that were made to cash in on the success of the horror has always been cyclical, in that, like, an amazing horror film will come out, you know, amazing for its technical mastery or its storytelling, its, like, its allegorical meanings, and then films will just try to capitalize on that for the next 5 to 10 years, and then we repeat the cycle. Like, you know, obviously, The Shining spawned a ton of movies trying to be like that just were not, you know, even close. You know, Halloween spawned the entire slasher genre, which almost all of it pales in comparison, you know, to Halloween, the original, you know, and on and on. But this film really was unlike a lot of almost any horror movie I can think of, in that it's just so, you know, not since, like, They Live as a movie, and that, I think that was even more on the nose. Like, no movie has come close to doing that level of class analysis and that level of, like, you know, just barely under the surface class-based storytelling than this film. And it's really hidden in this insane fucking movie, where it's just two actors the entire movie just absolutely fucking killing it, you know, chewing the scenery. I mean, Willem Dafoe, just all-time scenery chewer, but the acting in this film is incredible. The look of this movie is incredible. They actually shot it in one, what's the aspect? It was 1.19.
Yeah, it's a square.
1.19 to 1, which is almost a perfect square. So right. films today are in 16:9, which is widescreen. Films,
but like 2.34 or
3.5. Yeah. And now films previously were, television's 4:3 aspect ratio. So, you know, that's what we think of as a square is not quite a square. It's a little bit, it's slightly more widescreen, but, you know, films today obviously are shot in 16:9. Right.
So they shot this in a format that was, you know, the very beginning of cinema in the 1890s, you know, when you had the just experimental people going around and filming things on the street. You know, when you could first do that kind of thing, this was the aspect ratio you had. But here, it's not just a stylistic tool. It really helps, you know, you like magnify the confinement of this island and this lighthouse and this tiny space they have to share. And there's enough room that, like, they didn't have to share a bedroom, but it's just one more thing of, like, you know, like the idea and old timey nautical thinking was like all the men sleep in the same room because that's your job, right? And you can see how that, you know, doesn't necessarily lend itself to camaraderie when it's just two of them and one has total power over the other. And we get that from the very opening scene where you don't see where William Dafoe is for the first few minutes. You know he's there, but you don't see him. And then you realize he's behind this chimney, and he, you know, the first sound he makes is to fart, right? Like, that's his introduction.
Right in fucking, in Winslow's face, like, right,
So, in the script, you know, because he does, you know, change his name, right, and ultimately you find out they actually have the same name, in the script, they're just referred to as young and old. So, it might help our discussion.
Yeah, we'll just refer to them that way. That's young easier and old, than...
Yeah. Because they are sort of a reflection of each other in, you know, just as characters, you know, and towards the end, Old even says, like, oh, you're making a fine, you know, you'll be a fine light keeper someday. And he's like, why not now? Right. and so there's a little bit of that of, like, you know, this is potentially he could become this older guy, you know, although the modern times would probably suggest that he wouldn't be exactly like that. One of the things I loved is how different their accents are and how authentic each accent is. That was a big part of his first film. It was getting the accents correct for the time period. Now, of course, you don't know exactly what people sounded like in, like, the 1600s where The Witch takes place. But you can get pretty close, and it's bizarre because when you get an accent really close to what it really is, or the, you know, the vernacular or whatever, it's almost unrecognizable 100 years later. Like, you have to watch this with subtitles because the, you know, William Dafoe's, you know, manner of speech and accent is so, you know, Nova Scotia-esque that, you know, it might as well be Scottish. Like, you can't understand what the fuck he's saying half the time. And when he, you know.
And I watched this with subtitles because I the first 5 minutes I didn't have him on, and I was just like, I'm not going to understand anything he's fucking saying if I don't, you know, watch this with subtitles, because it's the dialect and just the words and the phrases and on top of that, you know, obviously the accents.
Sure.
Are fucking insane. But as you said, there are, you know, as historically accurate as they can be, Pattinson, I think he modeled his after like almost like a Maine fishing, like a fisherman from Maine from the times.
Definitely more of like a modern, like, transatlantic kind of an accent. Whereas
super funny when he really, like, starts raising his voice kind of towards the end, because it's like he sounds ridiculous, but it's accurate to the way people from that region sound. But it's just so absurd that, you know, it's...
Well, in this takes place in like the 1890s. They don't give you an exact year, but even by then, you know, William Dafoe's character's accent would have been fairly antiquated. You know, it would be something from, you know, more common in like the 1830s, right? So it's clearly like he is an old timer, right? Whatever, you know, story he's telling about his past, which is probably a lie, you know, that accent did come from somewhere. So he has lived that part of his life authentically, at least.
And he does contradict his story multiple times, like about how he lost his leg or lost his, you know, function.
Well, but I love that they're both such unreliable narrators that you don't know if it's a hallucination that Young is having or it's just gaslighting that Old is telling, Right.
The whole movie. Yeah. It's incredible. Right. The way you, like, I still don't know exactly, like, did he actually pull up a lobster thing with the ex partner's head in it, or was that a hallucination? Like,
yeah, would it decomposed months ago. Like, he wasn't even there before, you know, he wasn't even on the last rotation. So that head is clearly, like, if it was, you know, it would just be a skull. I mean, it would have been eaten by crabs by now, you know?
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. None of that matters, because the story being told isn't really a literal one anyway. It's a fable, right? It feels like it's mythology because it is based on mythology. It's somewhat based on the myth of, oh, what was it?
Prometheus and Proteus. Yeah. So
yeah, and also the Greek myth of Sisyphus.
That's certainly in it.
He was cursed by Zeus to have to push a boulder up a hill every day for eternity, that would then roll back down the hill at the end of the day, in which we see Young has to haul the entire barrel of fuel oil up the stairs, and then he gets to the top, and the old is there, and he's like, "Hey, next time use this little can to just bring that up." And it's like, "You could have you heard me doing this. You heard me struggling for an hour to get this thing up here. You were up here this whole time. You could have fucking told me." And he's like, "Oh yeah, take it back down now." And it's just like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Like, that's, yeah. I mean, that level of abuse, you know, we'll get more into the, you know, the alienation from one's own labor here. But, like, that's like very close to the beginning where you realize that this is, there's an element of sadism here that is completely unnecessary. It's not just the boss doesn't want to work. It's the boss, you know, taking pleasure in watching you needlessly struggle.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and again, that's something that I really, you know, I appreciated in the Lies of the Lighthouse videos. He really pointed out all the moments where, and I'm sure, you know, most people listening to this, like us, have dealt with low-wage jobs, and or maybe are still dealing with low-wage jobs, where you're constantly dealing with this dichotomy of your boss, who probably, you know, didn't work as hard as you to get to where they are, definitely don't work as hard as you do now for their benefit, you know, for their profits, and goes through this ridiculous cycle of lording over you and, you know, like ordering you around and then trying to be your friend, because it's like this fucking, I really think it's this almost fucking thing internally where, like, no one can ever admit that they're the bad guy. No one can ever admit that they're a bad person. So they have to, for the most part, I mean, some people are fucking psychopaths, but, you know, for the most part, people always think that they're doing good. And so they have to kind of rationalize their behavior in, you know, in support of their own capital gains, where they kind of, you know, they try to be nice and they're friendly, but then at the same time it's like, well, oh, but you can't, you know, you can't go in the lighthouse, that's my lighthouse. Like, the whole idea of the film is like, you just see Robert Pattinson slaving away the entire film, you know, shoveling the coal, just constantly the cut to him shoveling the coal in, and, you know, this backbreaking labor, cleaning the fucking the septic out and getting, you know, the shit spray, or like, oh god, the scene where he goes to dump the chamber pots and it's fucking windy and just so disgusting and vile.
Which was totally like it totally felt lifted from Big Lebowski. Right. And I love how he just screams, you know, rather than just stand there, he just fucking screams into the wind.
Yeah.
And that foghorn, that fucking eerie as fuck constant foghorn, you know, and the fact that he has to work right next to it, and, like, you know, earplugs, and his fucking eardrums are practically bleeding, you know, or he's carrying things that are so heavy, he has to, like, have a strap around his head, which made me think, like, okay, why don't you use the wheelbarrow for that too? Like, that seems unnecessary, but
yeah,
or even like just like the wheelbarrow is too small to carry much, and then it has a fucking metal wheel and tips over constantly. It's just like everything about this is like, why wouldn't you have like a pulley system to lift that fuel oil? Like there's so many things to make this job easier.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, that they're on this really remote island. You don't even know exactly where they are. They never say it. But that's one of the elements I love of really good horror films, is when they're completely isolated from society. You know, you think about, like, The Thing. You know, they're on the fucking South Pole, right? Or, you know, and there you still have
Shining. Like, The Shining is another movie.
Exactly. One of my favorite horror films of all time, Alien. They are completely isolated from society. You never see the outside world. You never see, like, any other space station. You know that there's a company that's in charge of everything, right? But you never see their face, right? Mm-hmm. But they have ultimate authority. And you can see that based on the class dynamics of the crew. You've got, like, the below decks crew arguing about the bonus situation with middle management, with Lieutenant Ripley. Like, so you know that there is a class dichotomy here, even though you never see the larger world. Right, but it's enforced by everyone accepting that that's the way the system is. Same as here, you know. Like we see Old as the authority, but he's not the authority. It's the Lighthouse Company. It's whoever the administration is that runs the Lighthouse and makes sure that these rules are enforced. That will look at the logbook and say, "Oh, your wages were docked. Oh, you're not going to get paid now." You know, and really, it's Young is the worker. Old is the middle manager. The seagulls are basically the police in this world. if you look at their function and the way they react to Young's behavior, the light of the lighthouse itself is basically wealth and capitalism in and of itself, right? But the real bosses are always invisible. They're never seen in this movie.
Yep.
But you feel them the entire time. You feel the authority they have over everything that happens in this, you know, and that dichotomy is really what makes this, the horror of this. You know, they always say that the scariest monster is the monster you show the least or don't show at all. That's what this fucking movie is. You know, the lights or the allure of capitalism is what they're attracted to. But the real power, the real terror, is always invisible in this movie.
Well, and I really think that, you know, Robert Eggers has only made one other film. It was a very, you know, low budget, you know, comparatively. The Witch only cost $4 million to make, which obviously is a lot of money to you and me, but for a movie that's fucking nothing, especially, right, you know, considering how much effects work and, you know, period, like, he probably made very little money for that movie. And up until then, he'd presumably been working a regular Joe job. So this is a guy who is more or less just an average guy who has not been, you know, entrenched in the fucking Hollywood system for, you know, 20 years and living in a multi-million-dollar mansion. Fundamentally understood the class struggle and put it into this script. But I just really appreciate all the little touches like that. And like, you know, the fact that Young is his whole, like, driving factor is, like, the reason he even stole Winslow's name and, like, identity. He just wants, he's not trying to become, like, a famous or, like, a rich and powerful. He's just like, I just want a fucking house. Like, this movie is an amazing allegory for the times we live in right now where, you know, our generation and the younger generations are just fucking struggling to keep their head above water. And the generation before us just has their hand on our fucking head and they keep pushing us underwater. And they didn't work nearly as hard as we did to attain the level of success where they're at. And now we're at this point where the gatekeepers of capitalism have cut the ladder behind them so many times that there's enough people underneath them to kind of lift the surge of the crowd to reach the ladder. So there's this panic that you see in society now where, you know, people are starting to understand their collective power and you know, obviously capital is not thrilled with that and they're terrified. So I really think that there's a lot of that at play in just his, whether conscious or unconscious, the way he wrote these characters and their interactions with each other. It just it feels very much like jobs I've worked. Like I it's amazing just the how much I can see myself in this movie, and I'm sure a lot of other people can relate. And it's just like,
sure,
I just want a fucking house. Like I don't want like extravagant. Like I just want to not. I want to have the same shit that you have for sitting here and doing fucking nothing and ordering me around. Like, it's kind of amazing. Right. Like just how he worked that in.
This film draws on, you know, certain horror elements, but it's also very much, drawing on the tradition of Italian neorealism, where you had films that were shot in black and white, even though color was already pretty prominent. And it was just about regular people doing menial tasks and how they're never going to get ahead in life, and contrasting with other people around them that were wealthier, that always got the girl, you know, and it was very much just like fucking like, God, this is a depressing fucking movie. Like, but that's what they were doing. They were like, this is,
yeah.
You know, it was very different than like the French New Wave, which was all about like, hey, anyone can have fun and be hip and fall in love. The Italian art house films, neorealism was like, no, everything's going to suck forever because that's capitalism and you're not on top and you never will be. So enjoy your crushing, your soul crushing job forever.
Right.
And I was like, you know, the Criterion Collection has some great Italian neorealist films in their collection. But, you know, I mean, you don't show a movie of someone just working without dialogue unless you're trying to show that the work itself is breaking them down, is something they don't want to do or something they're isn't rewarding. It's work that has no purpose or has no reward.
Yeah. Yeah. Which unfortunately, I think a lot of us in this country feel like on a daily basis, like that's just the level of, work of the work available in this country is almost all, you know, just backbreaking fucking like thankless work at this point. And like, nobody is in a position to actually better their situations in life because wages have, you know, flatlined over the last, you know, 40 years in this country. And the costs of goods have gone up to the point where, and you know, good services, living, you know, the list goes on and on to the point where it is just this permanent underclass that we've created in this country. So it you know, again, it's historically not a very smart thing to create for the people in power, but you know, they're going to ride that out until they can't ride it out anymore. I really appreciated that being reflected in this film. And you talk about, you know, Marx's theories about, you know, the alienation of work and things of that nature. I just really appreciate the attention to that. And I really do. I would love to hear an interview with the writer, director about that and how much of that actually went into his, you know, crafting of the story, or if that was just something he kind of instinctively drew upon just from his life experiences, or if he actually kind of, you know, set sure. thought to that.
Well, he clearly thought about it a lot because it's not just a shitty boss, you know, relationship. Yeah. It's also, you know, once they're off the clock, the boss desperately wants you to think he's your friend, you know, and not just to trick you, but like they feel, you know, they want to feel like they're, like you said, not the villain. Right. So they want to make you feel
one of the guys, like, you know,
exactly like, oh, we're all in this together. And by us, I mean, you're going to do all the work. Right, so
I may make 10 times more than you make for doing less work, but we're all in this together, you know.
Exactly. And that's, you know, part of that is maybe human nature, but once you institutionalize it, then, you know, that becomes a, you know, abusive system that is purely there to exploit you. Like, you know, the work that Young is doing, it has a purpose. It's to keep the lighthouse running so people don't crash their fucking ship and die, right? But the thing that makes it not worthwhile is that the boss makes it so just terrible by shitting on him constantly that there's no reward for it, and he, you know, loathes it after a while, actually pretty quickly. Yeah. Right, so, you know, like if you really wanted your workers to be happy, why not just let them, like, help them out, you know, tell them they did a good job, like, but
Give them more money, yeah. Like,
give them more, yeah. Like, make
let the him work let him in the light hat, like,
so that people don't hate their jobs, but they don't want us to feel rewarded or feel good about our work. They want us to hate our jobs. That is like fundamentally part of what capital is about: is making you always feel like you're never good enough, that you could be replaced at any second, so that you're working out of fear and misery rather than working out of camaraderie and meaning, right?
Yeah.
That's what socialism is supposed to be, is we all work for the greater benefit of mankind, right? And capital says, no. Nope, we want you to be exhausted and afraid.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it is by design, and the elements of this movie make me think of our society, where it's just like, you know, there's just little things that bosses could do to make, you know, this work more dignified or more enjoyable or more rewarding, and they just won't do it, and there's no reason behind it. Like, in this film, Old could easily let him could let Young tend the lighthouse like at night, like in alternating shifts, like the handbook actually dictates that they do, that they take alternating shifts in tending the actual light itself, but he just won't do it. And the whole movie, the light and the lighthouse are a metaphor for power, and it's just like, no, I won't even share this with you, even as much as the system says I should. Like, this is mine. Like, I, I don't care how much backbreaking work, you're never going to see the fruits of your labor. You're never going to be able to experience the fruits of your labor, which I'm just
until he's
basking
dead.
In.
Until he's dead, which, of course, he, when he finally gets a little bit of power and, beats him up and, we get a little bit of, like, a kink in this movie, which there's actually quite a bit of kink in this movie if you're into octopus tentacle porn, and he like half buries him, and then just he's like, okay, he's dead enough, and he didn't really do anything to kill him, he just threw some dirt on top of him and gets his keys.
Well, he did beat the shit out of him before that, so I would assume he was like near death just from being punched, in real life he would be. In a movie, you can never expect somebody to actually be dead from
blunt force trauma. But in true horror fashion, the monster always has to come back after you think you've killed it, right? Yeah. So they definitely tapped into that trope. But, and I love that he gets a fucking axe wound in, like, the shoulder, where it's just like, oh! Because that's probably not going to kill you. It's just going to get infected, and you're going to die,
You're going to have a bad time.
Tetanus is going to fucking kill you slowly. But it's still enough that we, we get that, like, when eventually he falls down the stairs, that, like, he was already potentially mortally injured.
Mm-hmm.
So when now we get fucked. The final shot of him being, his guts being picked to death while he's still alive by the seagulls, a.k.a. the police, essentially punishing him for, defying the boss, defying the system by trying to get a peek at capitalism the fruits of his labor for once. He's being punished by the police for that. We sort of assume that, like, he was injured enough by that fall and from the axe that he really is dying,
for sure.
There's also the whole purgatory angle of it, that it's, he's been dead the whole time and the island itself is purgatory, and that he'll never actually get to heaven or hell, that he's just being
directed
apart
by J.J. Abrams.
No.
and that's it's funny.
I thought that was Lindelof. I thought that was like the whole thing with Lost was.
Abrams produced Lost. That's what I said. But Lindelof wrote it and took over after the first season. The director talked about the Greek mythology influences, and that's a real tell if you're up on your Greek mythology that Young was supposed to represent Prometheus, because Prometheus, basically his whole thing was he steals fire from the gods and tries to give it back to the people who the gods have, taken fire away from. And for that, Zeus punishes him by, chaining him to a boulder and has an eagle come down and eat his liver. And then he wakes up the next day and his liver is regrown and he goes through the same punishment over and over again. And I mean, the last shot of the film is literally birds eating, Young's internal organs, presumably his liver. So, I mean, that was a pretty obvious allusion to that, but it's just interesting because he the whole time is just trying to steal the light. But it's not even really steal. It's basically just trying to, again, it ties into the whole metaphor of capitalism where he's just trying to get some of the fruits of his labor. He's trying to experience some of them himself, and for that he is punished by the system and by the overlords for trying to participate in the thing that he is actually helping keep.
And he's not even obsessed with the light until he's told he doesn't have any right to it. He's just like, I thought we were just going to share this, this task. And it's
this
only once it becomes
that I'm
this,
doing the most of the work to
right.
produce.
It's only after Old makes it this forbidden thing. And then he sees him up there dancing around naked, up in this ivory tower with it, that he begins to lust after it, And then when he finally gets it, the light opens itself to him. It opens itself by itself, which is like, okay, that's fucking creepy. Yeah. And then he looks into it and, he gives out the scream that's like deliberately,
cool
distorting,
effect,
it's past the the Reds. Just, you know, and the whole film, especially that scene, but the whole film is so David Lynch's Eraserhead in its tone, and how, like, the, you know, the background effects are just constantly, like, thrumming the machinery and the horn and everything. Like, I believe you said you've not seen Eraserhead before. Is that
right? I have not, no.
Yeah, you got to watch that.
But I've seen other Lynch, like Mulholland Drive. Like, I get his style of, like, just, you know, just this, like, weird, like, you know, surrealist kind of, like, you never fucking know what is actually, you know, happening and if it's actually happening. And even that last scene, like, I don't fucking know if he hallucinated the light open. The cool thing about this movie is, if you asked me, like, is this movie supernatural? I could not answer that, honestly. Like, I have no idea because, again, there's a lot of weird shit that happens. I don't know if any of it fucking happened or if he imagined it, if it's his isolation and you know, just being driven to madness.
He ends, like, the last several days or weeks. You don't know how long it is, 5 weeks, 2 days. They're drinking, I don't know if you knew what they were drinking. They were drinking turpentine mixed with honey.
Oh, God, yeah. I thought they were drinking, like, lamp lighting oil at first because, like, they kind of took it out of the these big kegs or whatever after they had gotten, so is the turpentine what they actually use to light the wick in the light? Like,
I don't even know, but I mean, it's basically paint thinner, right?
Yeah, no, God.
Which they deliberate, like, nowadays they put poison in that so that alcoholics can't drink it without getting violently sick, you know? So maybe back then it didn't have that to it, but still, like, You're basically drinking gasoline.
Yeah, right? No, I mean, it seems and like, it's like it, yeah.
Oh, but we put honey in there to make it taste better. And even old was like, you know, because you could tell that, like, Young had the recipe for this, like, very Freddie Quell from The Master, P.T. Anderson's The Master, where he knows how to make fucking drinks from garbage, basically, that the old guys never even heard of, right? And the old and old is, like, gagging on it. Like, the old fucking sea salt is like, he can't even take it. So you know it's bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that was great. Yeah, and that, again, just adds to the further destabilization of the narrative, where they're just constantly pounding fucking, you know, the liquor, and then when that's gone, the straight, like, fucking turpentine. Like, it's just, you never know if one or both of them are hallucinating, or if, you know, you're supposed to understand what's actually happening is real or not, and that just adds to the fucking unease, and it's just a great, you know, horror technique, and...
Well, same thing with Annihilation. Like, you don't really get the sense that any of what you're seeing is actually real. And part of that is the isolation. You never see the outside world in that movie. You're entirely contained within the subjective reality of the protagonist. And by the end of it, like, you don't know if she is who she was, or if she's, you know, metamorphosized, or if it's all been a dream. And that sort of existential dread that you are trapped in that subjective experience of somebody who is literally dying, you know, and when they die, the entire universe dies, makes you think about your own mortality. It makes you think, you know, what's the one thing that we all have to fear is death. You know, I mean, we all find ways to try not to fear death, but it's all going to fucking happen to us, and that's why.
So it's always there subconsciously in the back of your mind. Like, that's the ultimate fear that everyone, you know, always has. That was another thing I really appreciate about this movie is, like, I've talked on the podcast before about H.P. Lovecraft, and, you know, kind of, this was the most H.P. Lovecraft thing I've ever seen that wasn't directly, you know, an adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft thing. It perfectly captured the existential dread and you know, unease of his stories without directly adapting him. Now, obviously, it certainly drew inspiration from stories like his. I mean, he set a lot of his stories in nautical settings and in the 1890s, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of his kind of, like, other dimensional kind of creatures and you know, beings had, like, tentacles and things like that. So, like, there are certainly visual allusions to him, but it captured the just general unease and unreality and unreliable narration that is present in all of his stories. So I really, from that aspect, I really liked it also. I got that really cool vibe. Not since, like, Annihilation has a movie given me that level of, like, this is certainly indebted to that type of storytelling, but not obviously adapting a Lovecraftian story, but drawing
before
on
we
the
get out of here,
that he kind of
Two other small details that I had here in my notes was, there's three main types of stories, right? Three main conflicts, right? Mm-hmm. There's man versus man versus nature, man versus himself, and this film is all three of those at the same time. So it's very satisfying in that regard. One other thing I liked, this was put out by A24, right? Their studios.
Yeah, yeah, great.
And they always do great shit, but they always do great marketing and design work, and this like a lot of movies nowadays have multiple different posters, right, that'll come out. The main one though is just the two actors' faces on opposite sides of the frame of the poster, and they're like half cut off. Like William Dafoe, you can see slightly more than half his face, but Pattinson, you can't even see half of his face, you know. And you know, the thing that all the Hollywood studios say is on the poster promotional material, you show your fucking actor's face because that's what's selling the movie, right? <Yeah. laughs> especially two guys this famous. Now, this was one of several films that Pattinson has done that are sort of indie movies that have, coming off of the whatever those fucking vampire
Twilight,
tween, whatever the fuck they were. But he's got a marketable face, and they're completely hiding it. Like, I almost don't want you to know it's him. And, mm-hmm. His acting is so amazing, and the accent is so good. He clearly put a lot of work and a lot of time into this that you don't feel like you're watching him at all. Even William Dafoe, who you've seen him in everything, you forget that that's who you're watching. You're completely immersed in who these characters are because they did such a great fucking job.
Well, and I really this is why I'm like super excited about the Batman that Pattinson's shooting right now. And I think we've all experienced, massive superhero movie fatigue, and we've talked a lot about in the show about that.
Definitely.
And I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about that, if we ever get around to reviewing The Boys the last two seasons, because that show is completely predicated on that. But he's somebody who I think in a lot of ways is going to end up like Leonardo DiCaprio, where he got his start in kind of like tween, centric films or TV, where because he happened to be this like really good looking young actor, he got these parts in, in DiCaprio's case, it was like Titanic and then The Beach and like all these. I mean, he was on like TV shows when he was a kid, and same with Pattinson. He gets this role in Twilight, but it's like, no, this person actually loves acting and loves the craft of acting and loves actually honing their craft. And I really think he's going to, make a lot of weird, fucking awesome, interesting choices on the back of that. And then you look at somebody like Leo now, and you don't think of him as a teen heartthrob. You think of him as one of the best actors in Hollywood. So I do kind of project that path for Pattinson as well, after seeing his work in some of these little movies that he's just fucking incredible in.
I look at Leo DiCaprio, and all I see is Rick fucking Dalton.
Exactly. Oh man, the movie's so good. And Dafoe is just, everyone knows about Willem Dafoe. He's fucking incredible in this movie. That the scene of his 5 minute monologue, where Pattinson tells him he doesn't like the way he cooks his lobsters, and he just fucking loses his mind and like just goes on this long rant and all these sea curses he calls down upon him. And apparently they shot this in one take. And if you watch him, he doesn't blink for 2 minutes straight, Willem Dafoe, in this scene.
Yeah, when I watched this last night, I tried to drink for the same amount of time, like the whole time he's talking. I made it like maybe 10 seconds, I don't know how
it's
do
really
it.
It's really hard to do, yeah.
They must have like eye drops and just completely fucking soak your eyeballs before you have to do that scene. Because it I don't know how they do it.
Willem Dafoe's a supernatural being. I'm convinced that he just is able to do it without, because he's just a fucking lunatic. I doubt he was even told to do that. He's just a maniac. Like, he's such a weird actor that, like, I'm sure he just came up with that shit, like, on the spot, or maybe didn't even think about it and, like, was just doing it, trying to Because that's a long, like, complicated monologue. So he probably was just thinking, like, really hard about trying to embody what he was trying to fucking say. But he's, yeah, they're both just incredible in this movie. I love movies like this, too, that are just, you know, kind of two-handers where it's just two actors fucking, like, riffing off of each other the entire movie. Nothing else really coming in between them. And it was really, you know, like, the other thing I liked about this movie is that it really had funny moments at times, too. Like, it didn't feel like just a miserable, depressing, like, you know, like, slog of a movie. Like, it really managed to inject humor into this really droll, dark movie with, like, a dark soundtrack and dark. I mean, the image quality, like, the it was shot on this, like, really old, you know, like we talked about this. 35 millimeter, like this 1.19 to 1 aspect ratio film, and it this type of print is so dark that they had to like super light the set to the point where like everyone on set would wear sunglasses during the during the shooting of it. And but the movie is so fucking dark, like that it's just incredible that they the level of you know, and for people that don't know, you know, lighting for film, you always have to overlight. Like, whatever you're looking at is way brighter in real life than what you're seeing on screen. But, like, this is, because this is such old technology and it's, like, native black and white print, it really was so fucking much, like, they had to do so much lighting to get it to where you could actually see what was happening. It's kind of a technical, like, marvel that they managed to make this movie look as good as it does, like with the subtle things they did with shadows and lighting.
And there's a ton of CGI too. I mean, like a lot of the storms and waves, you know, the shots of the lighthouse island, like that's all CGI. All the seagull stuff was CGI. I'm looking at a bunch of the different like alternate posters that people made, and there's one where like it's like Pattinson's face, but then the top of his head is the ocean and the lighthouse is sticking out of it. And then there's another one where it's William Dafoe and he's like blasting the light out of his eyes at Pattinson's face.
Yeah, from that.
Although he's got clothes on in the poster version, he's not naked like it was in the movie. And then there's one where it's just the fucking seagull. It just says the lighthouse, and it's the fucking seagull like cawing, like, and that's the whole poster. Yeah. So I don't know if that was fan art or if that was like an official A24 poster, but it's pretty funny.
You know, one just real quick before we get out of here, another cool thing I noticed that I don't even think you brought up in that video that we were talking about, the Lies of the Lighthouse video, they use shadows and lighting to subtly imply the story about, you know, like the themes of you know, this boss lording over him. Because like anytime you see Pattinson in the lighthouse, he was always like usually seated or on his bed, and you always see Dafoe hovering over him, but then you also always see this much bigger version of Dafoe in profile and shadow, like looming over Dafoe himself. And it's like both, you know, representative of him lording over Young, but it's also representative of his overlords kind of pushing, you know, the shit down the chute, you know, so to speak, like, oh, well, we're going to order this guy around and he's going to order, you know, it was just a really interesting little bit of lighting that I thought was pretty deliberate that they used a couple times, especially inside the actual lighthouse. So I really appreciated that kind of visual touch.
Yeah, there's the one shot where Young is outside smoking, right? He's off shift, and you can see the light from the lighthouse coming around every couple seconds, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like lit for a split second, and then dark.
That's great.
And then one of the times it like passes over him. And William Dafoe's nude silhouette is like washes over him, almost like, "Hey, I'm naked on top of you," like just for a split second. And he's looking up at him, and he's not like shocked, you know. He's more just you know, angry, but ultimately like just accepting it that he can't do anything about
accepting
it.
His position,
exactly. It's not like, "What the fuck is the boss doing up there nude?" It's just like, "Yep, that's how it is."
That's life as a boss.
This is fucking capitalism.
Nude in the lighthouse. So fucking great movie. Really great little hidden gem by this company, A24, who's been putting out great fucking, like, really, you know, Midsummer they came out with. I think they did Hereditary. They did this great movie called It Comes at Night. Really moody, visceral horror movie. Like, they're really giving money to, like, these, like, really good scripts that are clearly, you know, not just schlocky, you know, standard kind of like haunted house horror. Like they really, I appreciate places like them and Blumhouse actually giving money to like Thinking Man's Horror and trying to kind of create this prestige horror kind of niche, you know, market right now, because not a lot of people are doing that. So,
What would you give this out of our hammer and sickle rating system? What would you give this?
I would give this five hammer and sickles.
Five out of five lighthouses. All right, I would give it like 4.7. You know, I mean, it's very not you know, it's not There Will Be Blood or anything, but I think for what it is, it's really fucking good. And I, you know, I'd heard nothing about it prior to.
Yeah, it was very, very small. I mean, you know, it got a wide release, but it was a very, like, not a huge, like, marketing thing.
And this is the kind of indie film that indie films aren't anymore. Like, indie films have turned into Little Miss Sunshine, and they're formulaic and boring and fucking just sanitized and have nothing to say anymore. And this is like what indie films were back when. You know, Gus Van Sant was first getting his start, when independent films were really doing something different than Hollywood was capable of or willing to do.
Exactly.
And that's, I mean, that's kind of, you know, A24's hallmark is like, let's make independent films independent again. let's fucking make some art here. So I definitely want to review more films like this in the future because, you know, Batman fatigue is real. if they ever show Bruce Wayne's parents getting killed again, I'm going to fucking riot. So they're actually,
yeah, come on, you got to get a shot of those pearls hitting the ground.
God, the fucking pearls. Cheapskate fucking Thomas Wayne bought his wife fake pearls. So they're actually shooting the Batman here in Chicago right now. I actually rode my bike down to one of the locations they were shooting that. They didn't have any filming stuff there by the time I was there, but yeah, they've been. Pattinson apparently has the COVID, so he's not been filming, but they're shooting like chase scenes all over downtown the last B-roll week or so. There's like a motorcycle chase, and they had a camera rig on the motorcycle. So it's like a POV shot, apparently. We're gonna see. Cool. Which is always, you know, I mean, I think it was fucking Requiem for a Dream just turned 20 years old this year, which is like, holy shit, that came out 20 years ago, and then go look at what Jennifer Connelly and fucking what's his
Jared
name?
Leto.
Look at what they look like right now. Like they're fucking like
vampires. Like
I know that when you're a wealthy Hollywood person, you get the best dermatologist in the world, but my God, look at those two. They're not aging. They're just not.
Well, I'm convinced that Jared Leto is a vampire and he feeds on the blood of the young women that he lures to his like island cult situation.
Well, I loved when like he came out of like some fucking desert retreat and like didn't know that the whole world was on lockdown, which was like literally a fucking episode of Black Mirror. The exact same thing happened. But yeah, I mean, like I love all the POV shots in that movie where the camera's attached to the actor. And everywhere they move, it's like this really jarring.
It's a great disorienting effect. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm hoping that with, you know, because I watched the pre-trailer for Batman, and I didn't really see anything that I thought was that unique or different to it. So I'm hoping that, you know, because they're still filming, they're gonna do something new. Because literally,
yeah, they only shot like 30% of the movie they said when that came out. But
yeah, if they're gonna fucking make another Batman movie every 2 years or 3 years, like do something fucking different, make it something worthwhile rather than just another recycling.
Yeah. I agree. I have some faith that Pattinson's a cerebral enough actor that he'll find something. He wouldn't have taken it if it wasn't interesting. The script, if it didn't have an actual interesting script and something to say, and also that he'll find something interesting to do with the role, but we'll see, who knows. I do like that he was like, I'm not getting in shape for this. Like he was like, it's fucking ridiculous. What do you think, a billionaire just works out obsessive? Like no, it's preposterous. But yeah, so that'll be interesting. That pretty much does it for us this week. Stay tuned, you know, check out our main political podcast where we talk about the issues of the week from a leftist, socialist, communist, whatever perspective.
Tanky.
That's Move Left Idiots. Tanky perspective. Yeah, no. And that's Move Left Idiots. That's you can find us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever the fuck it's called now. Just search for Move Left Idiots. SoundCloud.com/Move Left. Facebook.com/Move Left Idiots. Patreon is Patreon.com/Move Left. Merch available at tinyurl.com/Move Left Merch. I am on Twitter @Move_Left.
And as always, I'm on Twitter @BikeSlutty.
Yep, and the podcast is @MoveLeftPod on Twitter. And we will see you next time.
It's of a merchant's daughter they brought up in Callao. Hurrah, me other girls, who let me go? She took me in the parlor and said, won't you be me beau? Hurrah, me other girls, who let me go? Oh, do let me go, me girls, do let me go. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. Oh, all around the sofa, lads, and wasn't it to go? Hurrah, me other girls, who'd let me go? And about the hour of 12 o'clock, her old man, he come home. Hurrah, me other girls, who'd let me go? Oh, do let me go, me girls, do let me go. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. As I was out a-walking down by the riverside, hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. It was there I seen this pretty gal a-swimming in the tide, hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. Oh, do let me go, me girls, do let me go. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. As I was out a-walking all in the bright moonlight, hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. It was there I seen the gal a-swimming and her eyes they shone so bright, hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. Oh, do let me go, me girls, do let me go. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. I wish I was in Madame Gashie's down in Callao. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. Where the gals hold on your bobstay and they never let it go. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. Oh, do let me go, me girls, do let me go. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. We'll cast a line round Madame Gashie's and take the house in tow. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. We'll tow it back to Liverpool all the way from Callao. Hurrah, me other girls, do let me go. Oh, do let me go, me girls, do let me go.